This is Father Gregory Pine, and welcome to Godsplaining. Thanks to all those who support us. If you enjoy the show, please consider making a monthly donation on Patreon. Be sure to like and subscribe to Godsplaining wherever you listen to your podcasts. For this episode of Godsplaining, I'm very delighted to be joined by Dr. Ryan Anderson. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So many folks will know you from your work at the Ethics and Public Policy Center or from your various publications. I suspect a lot of people have come across the marriage book that you wrote with Professor George and Gurgis. But for those who perhaps don't know you as well, would you just say a word, you know, who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
Sure. I grew up in Baltimore, so to answer the where I'm from question, but we currently live in Lucketts, Virginia, which is in between Leesburg, Virginia and Frederick, Maryland. And we moved out here about 5 years ago. We had been living in Washington, D.C. On Capitol Hill. I used to have a 2-minute walk to work. And then we moved out here a year before COVID, and everyone mocked us and thought we were crazy. And I then had a 2-hour commute to work each way. And then, you know, a year after we moved here, the world shut down for 2 weeks to flatten the curve. And, you know, those 2 weeks became like 2 years in the D.C. area. And I got to work in this basement for over a year before having to go back to an office. And it was a great blessing. We had 3 kids born upstairs, two levels up from where I'm sitting. The first one, you know, a COVID baby, because the rationale was husbands aren't going to be allowed in hospitals and wives are going to have to wear masks. And my wife said, screw that. I'll just do a home birth. And then she liked the experience so much that the next two were also born at home. And there's something beautiful about that. But so anyway, that's part of the where I'm from, who I am. So I'm married. We have 4 children, ages 5 and under, which is always exciting. We live on a farm. We have lots of different animals. My day job, I'm the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And I would imagine like our viewers would be familiar with EPPC as George Weigel's think tank or Ed Whalen's think tank. Both George and Ed are past presidents of EPPC, and both are now senior fellows. George, you know, wrote JP2's biography, Witness to Hope, and just does a lot of Catholic stuff. Ed was one of Justice Scalia's clerks and, you know, does a lot of court stuff. And then for me, like I was educated undergraduate at Princeton, and then my PhD was at Notre Dame. In between, I worked for 2 years at the Witherspoon Institute for Robbie George, and then I worked for 2 years at First Things as an assistant editor there. And those ended up being the last 2 years of Father Richard John Newhouse's life. And so those were very, both of those experiences were formative experiences, getting to kind of do like unofficial master's degrees in political philosophy and then political theology with Robbie George and Father Newhouse. And then while at Notre Dame, before I wrote my dissertation, I wrote the book that you mentioned with Robbie and with Sharif, the book, What is Marriage? And that more or less like sealed my fate at that point. You know, no tenure-granting research university was going to hire me because I was on the wrong side of history as it was. And as a result, I would say like what that did is, you know, I like to quote the famous American political philosopher, Janis Joplin, that freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And so after like doing the gay marriage book, it was, you know, very liberating because like, literally there was nothing left to lose. Like anyone who hated me already hated me. And so, you know, the next book was on the aftermath of gay marriage and how that intersected with religious liberty. Then there was a book again with Sharif on anti-discrimination laws and religious liberty. Then there was a book on transgender ideology, which Amazon sold for the first 3 years after it was published. And then Amazon has disappeared for the next 3 years. And then most recently, a book with Alexander De Sanctis on abortion, which we had timed for the release of Dobbs. And, you know, all I'll say about that is that, like, you know, it was, had I been pursuing a tenure track job at a traditional kind of like research university, I wouldn't have been able to do any of those things because none of those things would have been received enthusiastically by tenure committees or by, you know, any of my peer outside reviewers, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm, you know, I'm very glad I did each of those things because like each of them was like an intervention in a public debate that was rather important. And we needed, to my mind, like serious thinking in rhetoric that was accessible and charitable and civil. And, you know, whether or not those books made a difference, who knows? But I was glad I was able to do them. So anyway, so that's the nutshell, who I am, where I'm from.
Yeah, that's okay. So it's funny, just even in the way in which you began describing where you're from or where you are at present, it's fascinating. Like the way that we talk about COVID, I think that there are various approaches to the issue. Like there are some people who like, you know, still treat it as if it were a thing. And then there are some people who avoid it altogether, just kind of in deference to the corporate trauma suffered by all of humanity. You know, it's like, it's better that we skirted aside. But it seems like there has to be a way in which to describe it, which both acknowledges that it's terrible, but acknowledges that it was crazy. You know, like I think that a lot of people were calling for apologies at a certain point as a way by which to kind of heal and grow beyond. And, you know, that didn't necessarily happen in the social and political setting that one might have hoped, or even in the religious setting that one might have hoped. But it's fascinating, like when we just talk about it and then talk about the things that we did during it, it's a way of like signaling, I'm here to have a real conversation. Like I'm here to talk about real issues. But then the way that some people do that, it's also like, I'm here to have a hyper polemical kind of posturing session wherein we don't actually talk about real issues. We all just get really, really worked up about things that we're never going to actually change. So something that I find cool about your work and about the Ethics and Public Policy Center is it's like, let's have a real conversation, but we're not just going to like beat the breast and bang the drum. We're actually going to try to encourage discourse. And I think that that's something that Robbie George has always done really well in hosting conversations amongst people who might not otherwise sit at the same table. So I don't know, maybe we could just pursue that a little bit. Like, discourse in 2024 and beyond within this current, you know, like social and political setting, what are principles that you deploy, maybe like ways in which you try to host these arguments that you find fruitful and that you ultimately find helpful?
Yeah, I mean, big question. But let me say one thing about COVID and then something about like the discourse question. I mean, so it's interesting in that, It strikes me that there are structural incentives for people not to admit they made mistakes in terms of the response to COVID. And I just think that's hugely problematic, that we can't have like a postmortem and look at what went well, what went poorly, so that we can learn from this to improve in the future. I mean, I know personally, a friend of mine was fired from his job as a university professor. This is Aaron Cariotti. He's now a colleague of mine at EPPC. And he was going to be like a visiting fellow with us in like a part-time capacity, because his day job is he was a professor of psychiatry and he was the head of medical ethics for the UC system. And then because he wouldn't take the vaccine, and you know, for him, he was like, he had already gotten COVID. He was treating patients at the hospital. And that's how we caught COVID. And he was like, look, natural immunity is better than vaccinated immunity. This is still experimental. You can't force me to take it. And so they were like, fine, we'll fire you. And so, you know, we now have to, you know, he has, I think it's either 5 or 6 kids and, you know, he needs a salary, health insurance, retirement, all that. And like, we're on the hook for that now. But he's also, you know, was it last week, the week before, there were oral arguments in the Supreme Court case where the Biden administration was pressuring Twitter to censor some of the medical doctors who were questioning the COVID regime. And Aaron was one of the Twitter accounts that was being censored. And so I think like, wow. You know, in his case, like it's very understandable why, you know, we think about like who were the victims of COVID, understood as like, you know, who were the people that got sick, you know, they might have passed away. But then also who were the victims of COVID policies, right? People who weren't able to have funerals for their grandparents, people who weren't able to visit their grandparents, people who lost jobs because they were speaking out on what they believed to be the truth. And in Aaron's case, it wasn't just that he believed it to be the truth. It turns out he's now being vindicated by more accurate data and science, things that, you know, he knew at the time, but the rest of us didn't know. So like, there's a part of me that's, you know, very deeply sympathetic to some of the people who are very frustrated by the lack of any accountability in the aftermath of this. During COVID itself, my wife and I, we always felt guilty because COVID was really hard for a lot of our friends, especially our friends who were still in DC. And then for us, you know, it might have been one of the better years of our marriage. It just, you know, my mom and dad, who were in their, they were 79 at the time, they had moved in with us for the first 3 months of COVID just because, you know, we didn't know at the time. Everyone thought, you know, if you were in your 70s or 80s and you got this thing, you were going to die. So, like, you know, they had just moved in with us. You know, our second child was born in May of that first year of COVID. And then, you know, another child came a year and a half. And so like, it was just great for family life. And then we were having every other weekend, a different friend would visit from DC, and they would just like bring their family to escape. And so that's why there's a part of me that feels guilty just about the unequal distribution of burdens and blessings of kind of like the COVID years. And that was true, not just like on a personal level, but if you think about like our public policy responses, the laptop class, like, you know, those of us who could Zoom, who could, you know, do podcasts like this, who could write, it wasn't as bad as people who had kind of like in-person jobs, you know, small businesses that went out of business, storefronts, restaurants that got shuttered and have never reopened. And there really was a class divide there between like the class who was making the public policies and the class of people who were suffering under those policies. So anyway, so I'm kind of still frustrated by the lack of any sort of real like accounting. So anyway, so that's one, you know, series of rambling thoughts.
Before getting into the discourse piece, I mean, like maybe that's just a way in which to like begin a conversation. I mean, it's like, who knows who will listen to this, and they will be limited. And as to the policy decisions that they make, it's probably your name that will attract those who could potentially make such like decisions. But like, I mean, a COVID after action review, I think that there's a sense in which, you know, like sometimes when people suffer a trauma, right, they want to keep that trauma, as it were, as traumatic as is tenable, as a way by which to leverage it. If that makes sense, like you see this a lot in the 21st century with kind of like perpetual victimhood. And that's not to like call any one person to the carpet, but you see how if you can't be a hero, you may as well be a victim, because it's about as powerful at this stage of the game, because it affords you within a kind of network of interlocking resentments, a great capacity to tug on some of those, you know, threads and get people tending in whatever direction you want. But it strikes me that like that just keeps going, right? And that's the type of thing that has to be fueled continually by, you know, like kind of corporate anger stoking, whatever sort. But like healing and growing, I mean, I don't know where you see that in the contemporary space as like at the level of policy. Like I think about, you know, like building back in, you know, post-war Japan, for instance. You've got like Nagasaki and you've got Hiroshima, and Hiroshima kind of like apparently leaves the bomb site as a big scar in the earth, whereas Nagasaki, it destroyed the Christian cathedral, and the Christians made the decision to build back, you know. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, maybe part of an after action review too is just kind of trying to determine like what it means to try to heal and grow, and that like how we host conversations in ways that are different than our secular contemporaries, who are just looking to kind of accentuate the trauma, leverage the victimhood, and seek structure, ways by which to continually push and pull. I don't know if that's a fruitful line of inquiry, but yeah, your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, and it strikes me that it applies not just to kind of like the COVID, you know, experience, and then the COVID response, and then the COVID aftermath. I mean, it strikes me that this is like the majority, this is the framework in which the majority of our kind of civil, political, cultural debates take place. I mean, whether we're talking about like transgender issues, whether we're talking about race issues, even some of like economic class issues, there very much is the intersection of identity politics with like a victimology, and almost like a victim totem pole. And who, you know, where's your status on the hierarchy of intersectional victim identity groups? And I could just tell from like the way you even like phrased the observation that like some of this has to be coming from the confessional or coming from spiritual direction. It strikes me, and obviously you can't, you know, say too much about that given the seal, but it does strike me that like a huge part of just like personal growth and spiritual growth is not viewing yourself as a victim of forces outside of your control. Or when you truly are, because in some cases we are. I mean, there are things out of our control that we might have suffered setbacks as a result, but not allowing those setbacks to define you, and not allowing those setbacks to be crippling. And like seeing that, like, you know, even if like there's a certain amount of an area where there's nothing we can do about it, there's a whole swath of reality where we have huge agency There's a scholar at AEI, he's done some charter school work up in the Bronx. His name's Ian Rowe, who really talks about the importance. He works with like inner city Black students, he talks about how do we raise like resilient students, and how do we like emphasize that they have agency, and that just strikes me as like hugely important for this next generation. I just finished reading books by Brad Wilcox, Tim Carney, and Abigail Schreier. They're all like, you know, one is titled Get Married. That's Wilcox's book. One is Family Unfriendly. That's Carney's book. And one is Bad Therapy. That's Abigail Schreier's book. But all of them kind of like, you know, in their own way, hit on a common theme of like, we're raising this next generation to be insulated from real life. And as a result, they lack agency. They lack resiliency. A lot of it, you know, is our fault as parents who have, you know, in Abigail's argument, like, you know, we've ceded too much ground to the therapists, and we've allowed like a therapeutic approach to parenting, a therapeutic approach to education to take place. You know, Tim talks about like how like we have a whole host of cultural and political and economic policies that just make it unfriendly for family life. And as a result, that's leading to bad childhoods. Brad points out that we're not getting married. The decline in marriage is having huge problem. But anyway, it strikes me that, how did I get on the tangent of those three books? I mean, it strikes me that all three of them are pointing out that from the time when you and I were children to today, something has changed in childhood. And it's leading to, and as those children now come of age, I think it's leading to a whole host of kind of cultural problems that we see first playing out on social media. And we always say social media isn't real life. First plays out on college campuses, and we say college campuses aren't real life. And then those people enter the New York Times, right? And then they start like getting rid of columnists, and they start like rejecting the edits from their editors. And we see, and you know, Barry Weiss has to leave and then start the Free Press, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a rambling answer there, but it strikes me that there is something that's going on with the intersection of identity politics and like victim identity competing for rank, and then like a lack of agency and a lack of like failure at younger ages that then allows you to be able to fail as you get older and to respond to the failure, right? And if you're always protected in a bubble, then if you have a setback later in life, it can be entirely crippling. Whereas if you're used to, you know, you have ups and downs as a child. I played on a college football team that never won a game. 4 years at Princeton. And my high school football team wasn't much better than that, right? So I had these great experiences of defeat, of failure, that set me up really well for being on the wrong side of history when it came to gay marriage or something like that. Rambling response.
Yeah. No, that's great. And I think that affords us a nice entree to just like talking a little bit about social and political engagement or citizenship, because I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, so people endure much, all right? There's much in the way of pain and suffering. It's going to find us all in our particular lives. And we might think, you know, by comparison to this person or that person, I've suffered nothing. And yet still, life in the 21st century, whether it's privileged or unprivileged by, you know, the denominations of our contemporaries, it's still tough, right? Because it's not straightforward. Whether it's better than or worse than other times, I just think is an unfruitful comparison in many ways. But like many of us experience our humanity as somewhat complicated, or at the very least, somewhat sad. Okay, so then given that, and then given the fact that sometimes we have additional pain and suffering visited upon us by, you know, antagonists of whatever sort, and then there is this kind of ambient culture in which victimhood is the name of the game, and we need to just like fly our victimhood flag and then take that with us into whatever, you know, paradise or utopia of, you know, equity. It strikes me that, you know, like as Christians, there's a recognition of the fact that, yeah, we've been done unto, but we've also done unto. And that's just part of being born into a network of relationships and contributing to a network of relationships. But we've also been forgiven. We've been given, you know, like we've been afforded the resources with which to heal and grow. That sounds so sterile. Jesus has saved us. And so in light of that fact, like this point about agency, I think is so crucial. Like your real life isn't elsewhere. Your real life is here and now. You know, the graces that God is actually giving are the only graces from which you can profit. And so like taking that sense, you know, that kind of spiritual sense or religious sense, and trying not to silo it or isolate it to the merely not or the limitedly spiritual and religious. Like, how do we carry this with us into our, you know, like our social and political setting? Because I think, you know, 2024, people are looking at the vote that they may or may not make, and they're probably somewhere between despondent and bemused. And just a lot of people just kind of throw their hands up and say, like, I don't know what to make of this, and I don't know if I matter. I don't know if I count. Like, what do you, how do you counsel that person, or how do you speak into that space?
Yeah. A couple of thoughts. I mean, one is, I think your observation is entirely correct about, the broader culture seems to have a lack of mercy and forgiveness. And it strikes me that that is something that, like, Christians at this moment in time in particular, are maybe the only ones who are equipped to kind of like speak into the culture on this. Cause it just strikes me like our discourse is very focused on injustices. And I would say like most of like the, kind of like what gets labeled woke, it's not so much about justice, right? Cause there's not like a positive vision of the good. It's more about like pointing to things that people view as injustices, and then not having room for reconciliation, for mercy, for forgiveness, right? And so like we see people get canceled because they say something stupid online or whatever, but there's not a chance at like a second act, right? There's not a chance at, okay, I said something stupid, let's move on, life moves on. And it just strikes me that that's going to be how Christians navigate that, and what we could bring to the table to offer about that, to offer that would be very valuable. If I remember correctly, the very first editorial of the journal First Things said something like, you know, the very first thing to say about politics is that politics isn't the first thing about human life. Do you remember if that's a loosely accurate paraphrase? But it was something like that. And like Newhouse's point was that politics isn't first. Politics is a penultimate discipline, right? The ultimate things in life are ultimately, you know, about our final end, right? And it's going to be about, you know, heaven, the kingdom of God. It's going to be about the church. It's going to be, politics is still important, but it's a penultimate discipline. And therefore, it shouldn't be all consuming. It shouldn't be our transcendent horizon. Like, you know, Christians should have a very different transcendent horizon. And that actually gives us perspective to kind of like put politics in its proper place, where it's neither unimportant, nor is it all consuming. And I'll say like another problem of like secularization is that politics has become many people's religion on both the left and the right, right? So I think like the secular post-Christian right, the kind of like Barstool conservatives. I mean, there is a way in which what we had originally seen on the left, that, you know, politics was the religion of people who on the left side of the spectrum had secularized. There's also now like a corresponding version of that on the right. And there was that famous Ross Douthat op-ed, I think from like 2016, like, you know, right around the time that Trump won the election, where he said something like, if you hate the religious right, just wait till you see the post-religious right. And I think we're seeing that. There's some very unhealthy trends, especially on like the very online post-Christian right. So I think one thing that we can bring to the table here is like, you know, just realizing that politics is not the end all be all, but that also means we can't be quietists, right? And we can't just like separate from this. So it puts it in a certain perspective. I then think that that requires of us to realize that politics is governed by morality, all right? And so like the virtues that we seek in every other aspect of our lives, the virtues that we try to instill in our children and every other, like we need to seek to exercise those virtues in our political lives. And that means like if we're a politician, we can't segment out questions of morality and virtue. If we're a policy person, if we're a talking head, if we're a columnist, if we're a scholar, like, I mean, we need to live an integrated life. And in the same way that we say to business people, you can't segment out your Catholic identity from how you run your business. Or we say to scholars, you can't like, you know, bifurcate yourself from like, I'm a Catholic when I'm in church, but then my scholarship is like, we want to live an integrated life of the mind. We want to live integrated vocations in the marketplace. We also want to live integrated lives as citizens. And so I think what that's going to require of us is both how we engage needs to, you know, have a heavy dose of virtue, with a heavy dose of recognizing the importance of politics, but ultimately the limited importance of politics. So part one. But then part two is that there are substantive truth claims that politics does need to vindicate. And for me, like I've always been struck and continue to think that John Paul II got this correct, where he said, like, the crisis of the 20th century was a crisis of faulty anthropology. And I think that the crisis of the 21st century is faulty anthropology on steroids. And I say that somewhat tongue in cheek, because, like, literally in the case of the transgender thing, right, we have faulty anthropology on synthetic, you know, testosterone and estrogen. But it's all based on, like, a false understanding of the human person. And I think that's going to be another area where Catholics in particular have something to offer to the political discussion. Is like, you know, what is the truth about the human being? And, you know, I've sometimes schematized this as, for the early church, the debates were largely about the nature of God. And so all the heresies were about, like, Christology and Trinitarian theology, things like this. Fast forward a millennia, the Church of the Reformation, Counter-Reformation, the heresies were not primarily Christological or Trinitarian. The heresies were primarily about salvation and about ecclesiology, right? So it was sanctification, justification, soteriology, ecclesiology, things like that. And I would say the result of both of those debates, we got richer orthodoxies, right? I mean, so Athanasius doing battle on the nature of God gives us greater insights into Christology. The Counter-Reformation, this is, you know, sometimes when I speak to mixed audiences, I'm like, whatever side of the Reformation you come down on, the church as a whole got richer theologies, right? Which I do think is true. Like, I do think, like, the Reformation led to greater insights in the Counter-Reformation. And I think something similar is going on now, except the heresies aren't about God and they're not about the church. The heresies are about man. And so we're going to, orthodoxy will ultimately prevail, and it's going to give us greater insights, greater appropriation and appreciation for the truth about the human person, both inside of the church and in the broader culture. I mean, I think to a certain extent, you know, many of the debates that, you know, many people thought were settled during the JP II and Benedict papacies about things like proportionalism and moral absolutes and, like, how we think about moral theology. And, you know, some of those debates have been reopened. They all seem to center on the nature of the human person, and especially human sexuality and killing, things like this. And I think it's going to force the church to get a deeper appreciation for the truth. And then I think likewise, that's going to take place in the political realm. And so then, you know, what does that mean, you know, when it comes to public policy and things like this? Like, how do we foster a humane way of life? It strikes me that we have forgotten how to be human, and we don't actually have life scripts, ways of being, ways of living that actually accord with human nature, human dignity, and human flourishing. And so I think all of those areas are going to be, like, ways that Catholics can make, like, distinctive contributions in this moment in time. And, you know, there are a variety of other things. And if you go to the EPBC website, you can see, like, all the things that my colleagues are working on. But, like, that just, like, high level strikes me as a couple of thoughts.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting just thinking back to what you said about the post-religious right or the post-religious conservative movement, and thinking that kind of as of a piece in a certain sense with post-religious left or post-religious kind of liberal movement. It's fascinating. Like, we were in a setting not too long ago where, at this Sikh conference, where the question were, like, what is it about our culture that poses obstacles to thinking well about life and living our humanity well? And, you know, you were speaking specifically about sexuality, I think, and I was speaking about kind of fundamental moral theology without calling it that. And
it was very good that conversation.
Thanks. In the course of that conversation, I was thinking, like, when you are post-religious, when you are, you know, post-believing, it makes it really difficult to kind of transcend the push and the pull of, you know, the terms set by the dialectical materialists, because you begin to think everything about, you know, like you said, it's a matter of injustice and policing injustice or reassigning, you know, various material goods on the basis of perceived injustice. But it strikes me that you can never get a kind of God's eye view on your own humanity. You can never get out of the muck and the mire of your post-lapsarian struggles because you can't see them for such. And as a result of which, it's just like hard. And here I think about, you know, first things and the kind of call to return to first things. It's hard to reflect on principles. It's already hard to reflect on principles because you can't prove them and you have to kind of sift them dialectically, but like, it's just hard. And then as a result of which, you're not going to have any confidence that you're advancing arguments in a healthy fashion or in a positive direction, whatever the heck that means. But I think about this with respect to like the kind of post-Christian political landscape, because a lot of it is just argument by reaction. It's like I define against or I define by contrariety. And as a result of which, the principles get obscured, the arguments get totally, totally lost. And it's just shouting, right? Shrill shouting. So I think about like when St. Thomas talks about the principles of the moral life, he'll start with those things that we, you know, he talks about human action, but then he talks about those things that we share with the beasts, namely passions or emotions, or you might call them sentiments. And I think that, you know, at present, a lot of people are dealing with a kind of confused sentimentality, not to say that they are sentimental in a crass kind of Hallmark movie type way, but like a lot of us are just dealing with a kind of maelstrom of passions, emotions, sentiments, whatever you call them, with which we know not what to do. And it's in part because we can't get like a vantage on our own humanity from another perspective, which can take it all kind of into account. So maybe just as a final question, thinking about our social and political lives as in part a kind of education in passion, emotion, sentiment. And then we had talked about mercy, we had talked about forgiveness. Like, what are ways in which, you know, like we can stand to grow in how we feel in our social and political lives as you know, like as people struggle with their despondency, as people struggle with their sadness, as people struggle with their anger, even as the algorithm promotes all those things because it knows that it leads to click, you know, like, so
yeah, of course.
If you could just speak to that as we wrap up.
That is a, that's a big question. So one of my initial thoughts, as you were speaking is that, it strikes me that like, given how, for many people, you know, you look at like the upcoming November election, and it looks like we have like a bad choice and a worser choice. And, you know, I won't define which is which, but like, that is, you know, how many people are viewing this. It strikes me that we should not be necessarily thinking in 2-year or 4-year or 6-year, you know, depending on which office we're looking at, election cycles, because none of the real problems that we are facing are going to be solved by the next election or by the end of the next administration. My colleague Carl Truman, you know, has used the image, and I think it's really powerful. He's a Presbyterian intellectual historian. And he says that, you know, his favorite cathedral in Europe, I believe it's the Cologne Cathedral. And he points out that not a single one of the workers who laid the cornerstone or who built the cathedral ever expected to worship in the cathedral, because they knew it was going to take like, you know, generations to finish. You know, some of these, you know, just the kind of amazing European cathedrals took, you know, well over 100 years to construct. And he's like, they built it anyway. You know, some of them, you know, they sacrificed financially or they did the labor to construct the thing because they were doing it for their grandkids and for their great grandkids. And they wanted there to be a beautiful place to worship. And they were playing the long game. And I think that, you know, something similar, I look at, you know, a lot of the work that you guys are doing at the Dominican House of Studies with the Thomistic Institute, with Aquinas 101, with, you know, I listen to the podcast, which, you know, just like the lectures that are given for the TI chapters. You know, I listen to them when I'm commuting into DC because it's a long drive and it's like perfect to listen to like a 45-minute, 60-minute lecture. I mean, it take the SEEK conference where we both spoke. There were like 20,000 students there. It strikes me that playing on that horizon, that this isn't going to be won with the next election, that doesn't mean we can ignore the next election, but it means we also need to be thinking about what comes next and who comes next. And that means we need to be like making investments now so that the election 30 years from now, we have two good choices, right? And what can we be doing now to lay the groundwork so that, you know, the next Catholic president that we have doesn't declare Easter Sunday like transgender day of visibility, right? I mean, and just like, how did we get to a place? And like, don't blame politics for this. Like, let's start with the church, right? How did we get to a place where we as the people of God have not formed our own people to believe and to live out the truth? And, you know, we have people on both sides of the aisle who have had this problem. And so it's helpful to think about, all right, well, what could we do to be part of that solution? And it's clear to me that, you know, DHS is doing a whole host of things on this. It's how I think about, like, you know, what are some of the initiatives we could start at EPPC that would be the richest fruit that will be born from these initiatives will be things that my successors get to take credit for, right? That I will not be president when some of the initiatives that we're starting now are actually like bearing their best fruit. But we have to do it anyway, right? Lay the cornerstone. So that was one thought. The other thought is just like, just in general, realize that the algorithm, as you point out, like these devices, the way that they maximize clicks, the way that they maximize user engagement is not by making us satisfied so that then we put down the phone and we go back to real life. It's by keeping us unsatisfied. And it's by making us somewhat angry. So we doom scroll. And so that, you know, we're in a fight with someone. Realize that we're being manipulated, and then do what we can to put guardrails on that. But then also realize that, like, this was, there are these two short books from the University of Mary. I don't know if you're familiar. One was like From Christendom to Apostolic Era. You probably have them on your desk. And then the second one, the religion. Yep, there we go. The Religion of the Day. And that most recent one, it came out right around Christmas time. I read it during my Christmas break. And it was really just pointing out that, like, a lot of people today are legitimately suffering, and they're not wrong. Because if you lack religious faith, and if, like, you see all of the various social, cultural, political, economic problems that we have, it can be crushing for people. And our response to that should not be meeting their cultural anger with our cultural anger and, like, have a gladiator match of who can bash the other the best. But, like, we should actually be in a position of compassion. And, like, yes, I understand why, like, you think things are so bad. But then we should, you know, take a page from St. Paul, but let me show you a more excellent way, right? Let me give you the reason for the hope that I have. And it strikes me like that posture is going to be much more successful. It's much more biblical. It's like, you know, it's the posture that, you know, we're told to take is to enter into the suffering of other people, not to deny that it exists or that it's real, but to actually show them how to work through it and how there is a better way of life, both in the here and now and, you know, for all eternity. And it just strikes me that these devices are corrupt us as Catholics, right? Because, like, that's not what we're being incentivized to do. So unless we're very intentional about not being co-opted by the algorithm, and we're very intentional about, like, how do we use modern technologies in ways to, you know, effectively spread the gospel and to effectively embody the virtues, we're going to be no different, right? And the salt's going to lose its flavor. And then in which case, like, you know, we're not good for anything here and now.
Yeah, but to be trodden underfoot.
Yeah. Finish the phrase there. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, so thanks so much. Yeah, I enjoy chatting with you, and I enjoy thinking about these things. So folks can follow up with you at eppc.org, but you made mention of the fact that Amazon doesn't always carry the books that you publish on account of the fact that they're too true. But where might folks also find some of the things that you've published?
Yeah. So, I mean, the book that Amazon doesn't sell, it's titled When Harry Became Sally. So it's, you know, it's a play on the movie, which, you know, many of our listeners are probably now going to be like too young to have ever seen the movie When Harry Met Sally. But, you know, it's interesting. So the reason it was titled that is, you know, for people who did see the movie, I think the movie came out like 1992 or something. And the whole concept was that, you know, men and women are so different that they can't, quote, just be friends. And, like, now we've entered a stage in which, like, men and women can be, like, interchangeable, and, like, you know, you could become a man or a woman or both or neither or somewhere in between. It's like, how did we go from, like, one extreme to the other extreme in, like, 20 years? But so the book is, you know, When Harry Became Sally, Responding to the Transgender Moment. Barnes & Noble, to its great credit, never canceled the book. So it's still for sale there. And you can get it direct from the publisher, which is Encounter Books. And then the other books Amazon does sell, but, you know, don't give Amazon your money. You can find them on Barnes & Noble. You can find them direct from the publisher. And I will say the most recent one is on abortion. It's with Alexander De Sanctis. It's titled Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything, Solves Nothing. And the thought process behind that was in a post-Dobbs world, we need to be in the convert-making business. We need to be in the persuasion business. And we've seen this. We have unfortunately won virtually all of the votes that took place inside of state houses, right? So when pro-life laws in red states went to the state house, the elected representatives voted to protect unborn babies. We have lost each and every ballot initiative. When citizens go to the ballot box, they have unfortunately voted for abortion. And so one of the things that we knew we were going to have to do is like, we need to equip pro-lifers to then be able to persuade people who are not yet pro-life. And we have to view them as people who are not yet pro-life. I mean, the mindset has to be, these are people who we can bring into the fold. And unfortunately, some of the polling I saw in the most recent referendum was in Ohio, and it showed something like, I believe it was over 30% of Catholics who went to mass at least once a week voted in favor of abortion. And so again, like let's just start at home. Like we have a problem in the pews. Yeah. And these aren't like the Christmas and Easter Catholics. These are Catholics who went at least once a week. A third of them voted for abortion, right? And so like we need to think about, how do we help form those people? How do we persuade those people? How do we equip those people to know that what the church teaches is true, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, the EPBC website, I'm on Twitter. I don't use it as much as I used to, partly because I actually like found that it was just bad for my soul. And so I mainly just like, things that I think are edifying. But it's, if you just do a search for my name, you'll find me on Twitter.
Okay. Yeah. Well, wonderful. Thanks so much.
Thank
prayers
you.
For you and your family.
Thank you.
And I look forward to the next opportunity to chat, hopefully in person. With 24,000 of our closest friends.
Well, now that you've mentioned chatting in person, I'm going to be following up on that. So,
wonderful. Thanks.
Expect an invitation.
Cheers to that. Awesome. All right, then turning to you, the listener, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Godsplaining. Be sure to follow us on the things, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I don't know if TikTok is still legal, but in the case that it is, I think we still have that. If you would like the episode, subscribe on YouTube, your podcast app, leave a 5-star review. If you determine that listening to Godsplaining is no longer in concert with your spiritual growth, then cease and desist, because the point of a podcast is to get eventually off a podcast. So helpful for a time, but not for life. So if you'd like to donate to the podcast through Patreon, you can find links in the description and or show notes. In the same description and or show notes, you'll find links for an upcoming retreat or two, and for merchandise and things like that. All right. So know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and look forward to chatting with you next time on Godsplaining.